this is the Angry GM's monthly live chat for the month of July in August. Okay, so the first take was me saying, calling it an annual live chat, and now I'm in the wrong month. Cripes on toast. And that was Cripes, C-R-I-P-E-S. No sacrilege here. Or heresy? Blasphemy. Blasphemy is the word I'm looking for. So no blasphemy here. Anyway, this is the Angry GM's monthly live chat for the month of June 2021. Hello, all. And I am joined by Arthur, Kylie Inc., Dave Korhol, Draco, K99, Milakot, Nitsua, Penguin, Retweeter, Shock3600, and Sword Person. And I realized that I should actually do, like, greet the people who actually showed up. Just to say thanks for actually showing up. So this is my live chat for the month, and I actually have notes for once, and I'm actually going to try and bring this in an hour instead of ending up like at the 55 minute mark saying, okay, one more question and then I have to go. And then, an hour and at the hour and 45 minute mark, finally saying, okay, how do I turn this off? Yeah, so anyway, so Biscuit grabbed the notes. Biscuit is not allowed in the Angry Games recording studio anymore. Biscuit has proven herself to be an obstacle to the process. Like so many processes. So, let's start with all the news that's fit to get angry about. The angry news and updates. If you have been following on Patreon, then you will know. If you've been following on Patreon, then you don't need this. And if you haven't been following on Patreon, then you don't know this live chat is happening. So we could just skip that. But I put out a revised content schedule where I just ran through when I was going to be releasing things because I had to move some stuff around. Unfortunately, I had a virus that robbed me of my voice a week ago. And it's, Drago said news to get angry about. Is this RPGs or politics? Nope, this is not politics because politics ruins everything. So you can go ahead and check out on the Patreon for the updated release schedule. Note that there will be an early access article on Friday. There was not one last week. And then there will be an extra article in June on Wednesday, the 30th. And that one is one that, people have been looking forward to. So I pushed it off to the way, way, way end of the month, because I'm an asshole. And that's the Let's Build a Simple Dungeon adventure. But anyway, so that's the updated release schedule. You can go and check it out. And also, hopefully on Monday, the first of my monthly content packs will be released for Frenemy tier supporters and above. I am you're working feverishly to get it finally finished. The first one is the hardest, to be honest. And there's also some... Hello, Proselis. Welcome. I'm not even going to go into that whole mess. And hello, Dan Floor. Anyway, hopefully on Monday, the first content pack will be available. If not Monday, then it'll be like Tuesday or Wednesday, depending on, just cleaning up the layout and stuff. And I shared a preview of it today so folks could see what they are getting. The theme for the first Imperial Star Destroyer, who also came in. I missed your arrival. The theme is what did I call it? Spring Rains. And so it basically consists of some rules for adventuring in bad weather, including some rules for finding shelter and campsite and making camp. Somebody got offended by that. Oh, Imperial Star Destroyer, because I didn't notice you coming in. He left. Okay. All right. Sorry about that. And then it includes some statistics for, I think there's five different monsters in there, including three primal spirit manifestations. So it includes some lore write-up about what the primal spirits are in the Angryverse. And I think there's an NPC companion in there also. I think the Stormlands Barbarian, which uses my companion rules. So, and then basically that's the idea of the content packs, is that it's going to be about 10 pages of miscellaneous game content for D&D 5th edition, because that's, you know, it's what I write and that's what everybody is using, or that's what the vast majority of my readers and supporters are doing. So, you know, it'll be some monsters. It might be some new rules. It might be a map. It might be, some lore, some companion NPCs, magic items, new spells, stuff like that. Usually won't be player content. Instead, it's designed to be stuff that as a GM you can drop in your world. So, and that's going to replace the secret stash. I've been talking a lot about it. This first one is really difficult. And I realized one of the problems is that I got really, really overambitious and realized that if I did everything that I had planned to do for this first content pack, it would have been 30 pages and it would have taken me two more months to finish. So some stuff had to get clipped and I had to kind of figure out a format and a workflow for it. Once I get this first one down, it'll be easier. So that's that, and hopefully it'll be coming Monday, if not Monday, sometime early next week. It will come out, and then there will be one by the end of the month to follow it, which will be themed around the Imperial Legion, and you'll see what's in that when it comes out. Meanwhile, for those who are members of the Inner Circle, the Frenemies for Life, and Victims of the Angry GM, I was running the Fall of Silverpine Watch games online, and a few of those were canceled due to my illness. They have all been rescheduled. No one who was in an upcoming future session, no one's schedule was affected, but if you want to make sure, you know where to find the schedule. It has been updated, so please make sure you check that. I'm really sorry about the scheduling disasters over the last 2 months. Everything was going really well and I was on target and hitting deadlines and getting everything out on time. And then Allie went through crunch, or the tiny GM, AKA Allie, went through crunch time to finish up her degree. And then she graduated. We had family in town for a week and a half. And then, some other stuff came up and then, I got sick and there was another little thing that went on. So the schedule was a mess, but things have settled down now. And I'm upset because I was actually getting early access articles out earlier than early. But anyway, enough about that. Sorry. Should be back on track by the end of the month, and putting out that content or the release schedule was key to it, because even if I miss those deadlines, just having the deadlines really, really helps me. I wanted to mention the Angry Open World game articles, because a couple of weeks ago I started I started this series of articles called The Angry Open World Game, AOWG. And I didn't expect it to be the thing that it was. It was basically me trying to find a way to run an open world game for my players. And I gotta be honest, first of all, we've had a lot of cancellations, so I haven't had as much time to tinker with my game as I would like. And I still have a serious pacing issue, both in terms of keeping the game moving online and also in terms of presenting things and keeping the game moving toward them and moving the game toward story, you know, toward game, moving the game. Like, okay, so the term pacing is a tricky one because you say it and there's like three different terms that are all, or three different ideas that are all wrapped up in pacing, and you can mean any one of them. So number one, pacing is how fast that you, how fast you run the game, how you keep the game moving, basically, right? So it's just a matter of, you know, how much time do things take to just get to you know, get through at the table, and how do you keep things moving forward? You know, that's what people think of in terms of pacing. And so when I say I'm having trouble pacing my game, and everyone says, well, yeah, it's online play. Everybody has trouble pacing games online. In fact, I think Penguin in the chat said I have the same issue with online play. And yes, that is part of pacing. But then there is also narrative pacing. There is the pacing of hitting story beats and, you know, tension rising and falling, but gradually trending upwards, maintaining a sense of narrative tension so that it feels like the story has momentum to keep it going. That's also pacing. And then there is also gameplay pacing, which is... I realize that now I'm really stretching the word pacing, because when you talk about gameplay pacing, you're generally talking more about gameplay flow. But it's like, you know, that's where you get into things like your gameplay loop. Like, how does the game play out? What are the players doing? You know, go to town, pick up some quests, then go out into the wilderness and, do a quest, come back, turn it in, sell your loot, yada, yada. You know, gameplay loops and cycles and that sort of pacing. So there are, whenever you're talking about a role-playing game, there's three different senses where you can mean pacing. And at the very least, I use it for three different, things, sometimes more. So when I say I'm having trouble pacing my game online, my open world game, I don't necessarily just mean how fast or slow the game is flowing. I also mean in terms of how the narrative is flowing and how the gameplay cycles are cycling. Okay, but anyway, so the thing that surprised me though is that the angry open world game thing caught on before I was ready for it to catch on. So I put out that first article, and there were like two or three aborted attempts to not start a series before it ended up being a series. And that was where I said, oh, okay, well, I realized I had made this mistake and not really told my players what was expected of them to play the game. And so I wrote an instruction manual, and I thought that was the lesson. And then I got a lot of feedback and people were really excited about, well, this game is amazing. This is exactly the sort of game I would like to run or I would like to play in. But of course, it's the sort of thing that would just be impossible for me to run. And so that was what led to me jumping into, okay, well, it's not impossible. You just have to change your approach to the game a little bit. And then it was, well, yeah, but there are things I am doing or trying to do and experimenting with that are sort of structural in nature and planning in nature. So, you know, that's why it suddenly became a series. And it will probably continue to be a series because it has proven to be tremendously popular. Everybody wants to hear more about this, you know. But the other thing it revealed is that there are a lot of basic fundamental skills that I think a lot of my fans, and I'm going to say this politely, you know, I'm not going to say this in the angry way. There's a lot of basic fundamental skills that everybody needs to go back to working on a little bit. Over the years, as I have been presenting more and more complicated ideas about pacing and things of that nature, you know, about how to design a game and what have you. I have moved people into the idea of thinking, well, that stuff's necessary for running a game. And now, if you take away someone's subsystems for this or that or the other thing, or you take away the complex design and you take away things like critical paths and gating and all of that stuff, suddenly you can't run a game. You can't design a dungeon. I want to take a moment to address this, because the chat has been talking about different people's audio issues and stuff. Look, Discord's audio is not the most reliable, and it is subject to a lot of, I don't know whether it's, you know, so stuff between the client and Discord's servers. Okay, so I realize that some of you are, like, one or two of you are experiencing audio issues, and then you ask about it, and then everybody else says, nope, it's fine for me, it's fine for me, it's fine for me. I'm really sorry. There's not a whole lot I can do about Discord's audio, but I am recording this entire thing, so if there's anything you miss, feel free to check out the recording, which will be posted in a couple of days. Okay, so anyway, The epiphany that I had in all of this was that I moved very quickly past basic skills and also have not really discussed basic skills in years. And I've had a lot of new readers appear in that time who, you know, they weren't around for, like, you know, the four simple rules for dating my teenage skill system and stuff like that. And I mean, that was an edition ago when I first started writing, you know, fourth edition was fairly new, you know. So it's been a long time. And so I am going to, and because the basic skills thing, Drago just said it was basic skills articles that drew them in. And yeah, basic skills were the thing that actually designed or defined what the Angry GM website became. And so over the next few months, I am going to move back to basic skills a bit, intersperse them, of course, with other stuff. I'm going to keep doing the Angry Open World game stuff. I'm going to do basic skills stuff. And I'm also going to finish off some of the rules hacks that I promised. But for the most part, just understand, because I know some people keep asking, like, when are you going to get back to this? When are you going to get back to that? And the thing is, as much as I don't like to leave abandoned projects and dead projects behind, I am also responsive to my community. Okay, so the fact is, for every one person who says, you know, when are you going to get back to this particular thing? I have 10 or 15 people who are all asking for the same new thing and saying, you really need to address this or you really need to address that. Okay, so I do my best to respond to everything I can. But I've got to follow where I think the community needs me to go, you know. So, you know, I will finish off projects because I really want them done. But by the same token, I'm always, you know, if I hit on something that really seems to strike a chord with a lot of people, you know, then I am going to run that through to exhaustion before I move back to some old thing that people have forgotten. Okay? Anyway, so that's that. The other thing I wanted to discuss is just as a side note, and then we'll, I guess it's not really a side note. I'm babbling a little bit here. The other thing I wanted to bring up, because it's an answer, an incident that happened in my personal open world game 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, some number of weeks ago, answered a question I receive a lot. And when I say I receive a question a lot of people will communicate with me through Ask Angry. A lot of people send me private messages on Discord. I still get a lot of messages on Facebook for reasons I do not understand, because I never respond to anybody on Facebook. But, you know, apart, and also, you know, Patreon messages. So people communicate with me in a lot of ways that aren't just the comments, which I like, by the way. I don't mind being approachable like that. In fact, I love getting that kind of feedback. One of the questions that I often get, particularly whenever I talk about player character death, is the issue of meaningful death. Okay, because it is no secret that I do not pull punches when it comes to killing PCs. I let the dice fall where they may, and when a game incident kills a player character, I let them dead. And I firmly believe that it is important that you let them dead. Okay? It's like, I believe death needs to be an important part of is an important part of D&D, and it needs to be a part of D&D. Okay? But whenever I bring that up, I always have these questions about, yeah, but what if the player wasn't ready for their character to die? Or what if the player, the character didn't get a meaningful death? The death was just at the hands of some mook who rolled two crits in a row. And then, you know, the character's just dead. What about that? And my response is, so I do allow my players to veto deaths, okay, in most situations. When a player character dies at my table, or is dying at my table, death saves are resolved secretly, and no one knows the status of the character until someone can reach the character and examine them and determine whether they're alive or not, and then take care, you know, until someone goes and kneels down and checks the character's pulse. Nobody knows if that character is alive or dead, except for the player making whose character it is. Okay, and the player has permission at my table when I ask them, is, you know, so the character dies, the player's making death saves, and, you know, I'm just, make your death save. I don't know what's going on. Okay. But then when someone kneels down at their side to determine, you know, okay, is the character alive or whatever, I ask the player, is your character alive? And my players are allowed to lie to me and say, yes, my character is still alive, even if it is not. Okay. The number of times I have actually had character or players keep their characters alive when they are not, because I do ask, you know, out of curiosity at the end of the session. I'm like, out of curiosity at the end of the session, were you alive or dead? And, you know, no judgment, no, you know, no pejorative there. I'm just curious. I can probably count on one hand, if I really went back through it, the number of times a player actually vetoed a death. Even when it was a, you know, a quote unquote meaningless death. Okay. But the Angry Open World game has kind of brought that question of the meaningful death back to the forefront. We had a character die in the game 2 weeks ago. Okay, it was Vestra the Wizard, who was immortalized, you know, she was immortalized in a previous article as the one who had the conflict with Marilla the Minstrel. And, you know, so she got mentioned in an article. She died. Okay. She died rather unceremoniously and as nothing more than the result of a pile of decisions and some unlucky die rolls. Okay. So ultimately what happened was the party was wasting some time. I don't say wasting time in that the players were wasting their time. The characters only had like a day and they needed to find something to do for a day. And they had rumors of a tomb and they wanted to find a gift to earn the Lord's favor. So they decided to go plunder this warlord's tomb and hope that they could find some antique weapon to give him and say, hey, yeah, we have this antique weapon here because we know you like those. And the party was handling the tomb very well. You know, skeletons were creeping out of the alcoves and the walls, and there were standard arrow booby traps and stuff, and you know, all the normal stuff you would expect in that kind of tomb. And it ended up that the wizard and the rogue, because they were the most alert, were sweeping ahead of the party for traps. Which worked out fine. They actually had a system where they didn't even have to make rolls for traps. They analyzed, you know, they learned enough about how these traps in this tomb were set up that they came up with a system for detecting and tripping and disarming the traps without even having to make rolls to search for it. They were just sweeping out ahead of the party to do it. While meanwhile, the paladin and the cleric were moving along behind, smashing skeletons in their alcoves before they would wake up behind the party. So the party was handling things really well. The problem was they blundered into a different kind of trap later on in the tomb, which was a pit trap. And while the rogue managed to avoid falling into it, jumping backwards with a good reflex save, Vestra the wizard plummeted to a lower level of the tomb, took some serious falling damage, and then the skeletons that were in the room below rolled tremendously good initiatives, and the party did not. So Vestra the wizard had fallen, she was crippled, she was alone, surrounded by these skeletons who immediately jumped on her and tore her to shreds. And by all accounts, that would be what would be considered to be what would you call it? Like, I mean, that's the perfect example of just like a meaningless death, right? This, you know, like, oh, I failed to detect a trap and then I fell through the trap and then I failed an initiative roll. And then all of a sudden skeletons ripped me apart, you know? Okay, fine. Yeah. Right. Not a heroic sacrifice, not a great moment, not something that's going to be remembered or sung about. And the quest was not even for anything remotely useful. It was just they were just plundering a tomb to waste some time while they were waiting for a festival and to do birthday shopping for the Lord. But what happened after it was very interesting, and it goes back to the whole minstrel incident. Because Vestra the wizard had been going through a little bit of a crisis. The encounter with the wizard, with the minstrel, and another encounter, these were all happening in her hometown where she had grown up and not been very well liked, and then come home to with total disdain for her hometown and the people who live there. You know, she was like a really mean-spirited Belle from Beauty and the Beast, you know, who wakes up every morning singing about how stupid the people of the town are and how much it sucks. And she was basically of that attitude. And she was being called out for it. Like, you know, and it was the minstrel who specifically made the comment that, you know, maybe people wouldn't hate you so much if you weren't so bitter and spiteful toward everybody, and maybe you wouldn't be alone and miserable. And it was, you know, that was the, I referred to that as dealing social damage, because that was his barb back at her. as she was talking about, you know, well, what are you doing in this small town, you know, this pathetic little town, if you're such a great minstrel? And he's like, I don't think this town is pathetic. It's a nice town. The people here are good. And maybe if you took some time to like them and not be a jerk, you'd know that. And they would be happy to have you around. And then she died in a tomb. You know, literally, like, the next day she was dead. I guess 2 days later she was dead. And the party, now with her body, the cleric looks down at her body and says, I don't think we should bring her back to the town. I don't think she'd want to be buried there. And then there was the realization that they had no idea where else she had come from, you know, where she had spent 10 years of her life after she moved away from the town and had come back, and whether she had any attachments to anything in the world other than to her raven familiar. And so ultimately, they decided to just burn her body right there, say a few nice words, and that was it. And it was in that moment of, you know, there's no connection to anything in the world for her, that I walked away, you know, that was a powerful moment for me. Okay. It was one of those powerful story moments, but I didn't realize it right away. It was only afterwards that I'm thinking about it. I said, you know, if you look at this from a certain perspective, that is actually a sad, tragic, but totally meaningful death for the character. Okay. And of course, it just happened to work out that way. And that's what the nihilists and the existentialists would all say, right? It just happened to work out that way. Except if you assume there is a meaning to an event, you can usually find one. See, there is this philosophy that people make a lot of fun of. And it is summed up in the belief, everything is a blessing or a lesson. Okay? And you can take that as a sort of spiritual belief that everything that happens happens for a reason, that there is some kind of inspiration behind everything that happens, right? Or you can take it as the idea that every moment in your life and every event that happens, when you put it into the context of everything around it, everything that has led to that, what have you, okay, then you can find a lesson there. You can find a meaning there, okay? If, you know, and that meaning will give you some strength. You will draw strength. The idea of everything is a blessing or a lesson is, instead of taking everything that happens in your life as something that makes you weaker, something that weakens you or saps you in some way, if you take everything that happens, even the things totally beyond your control, as either, you know, some kind of benefit to you, or as a moment for you to learn from, so that you can at the very least avoid that thing happening in the future, then that becomes, you know, these moments where instead of being a victim of circumstance, you draw strength from even the random occurrences in your life. You say, okay, yes, this thing happened. It was totally beyond my control, but there's still got to be something I can learn from this to make myself better. Now, I am not espousing this philosophy, and I am not offering anybody life advice. Okay, And I'm also not denigrating anybody who chooses to take the everything is a blessing or a lesson philosophy as more of a sign of divine or spiritual or some other intelligent design to their life. Okay. This has nothing to do with the philosophy. This has to do with the idea that if you go into a character's death, assuming there was a meaning to it, you can find it, okay? You can find how that, you can, you know, you take it as, well, this is the story. The character died. That's the story. It's beyond your control. What can be drawn from this? And now Vestra, instead of just being this meaningful death, because, and seriously, the players could have been bitter about it, especially Vestra's player. She could have been very bitter about the fact that, you know, she ended up out in front of the party and by basically the pit trap was a death sentence for a wizard. She felt like there were decisions that the players could have made that would have changed that, you know, because the way that they proceeded through the tomb, for instance, had they gone a different way, they would have cleared that room before Vestra fell into it. You know, but there was no way that they could foresee those things. So it's not like they could make these decisions and say, well, we should have done this. We should have done that. There was, they made the decisions they made. They were all smart decisions. And yet Vestra ended up out front. She and the rogue stepped on the pit trap. The pit trap gave way. And then through a series of crappy die rolls, Vestra was destroyed before she could even take an action. The player could have been utterly bitter about that. And for that matter, she could also have vetoed the death. But she didn't. And she said that it was a matter of, you know, a fair play thing. That, you know, it was a fair death. It was earned. You know. And on top of that, the characters and the players, or the players themselves, could have gotten annoyed and said, you know, this was just a screw job. But instead they took it as part of the story and then said, well, okay, but what do we do with Vestra now? She really has no ties. She has no connection, you know, and then her ravens sat there watching the funeral and then flew off into the distance, never to be seen again, you know? So, you know, to all those people who ask me, how do you make a meaningful death in a game where you let the dice fall where they may? My answer is that you cannot make anything meaningful. Okay. As a GM, you cannot create meaning. Okay. And I actually have an article coming. The article that's coming on Friday is another take on this whole, another take on this whole idea that as a GM, if you're trying to create meaning, you're going to fail. But there are definitely things that you can do to rob the game of meaning. Okay, but the point is that you cannot create a meaningful death, and you should not try to, because a meaningful death is, in the end, a contrivance. It is a railroading. It is either the player railroading their own story to whatever ending they feel is appropriate, or it is the GM railroading the character's story into whatever ending they feel is appropriate. But in no sense is it allowing the gameplay to determine the outcome, okay? So instead, what you need to do is assume a death is meaningful. Even the crappy death at the bottom of the pit after, when the skeletons, you know, jump on you and destroy you and you didn't even get to make a die roll. Assume that that is the end of your character's story and find what meaning in it you can. Because it's part of the story now and it's therefore good enough. It's a good ending. I won't say it's not a happy ending. Vestra's ending was not happy. But it is a good ending for her character. It's tragic Because, and you know, it's tragic because it also has that lesson of, you know what? She learned her lesson too late. She was just about on that epiphany of, you know, maybe I have been living my life wrong. And then died before she could, you know, reflect and make that change. Well, that's a lesson too, right? That's the lesson of don't wait too long to learn your lessons. Don't wait too long to take stock of your life because you never know when the end is going to be, right? Why isn't that a good story? If you're concerned about a good story, that's a good one. Anyway, that's my spiel on meaningful death. And also, I wanted to honor Vestra's death, and I wanted to also brag about my amazing players. Vestra's player handled the situation amazingly, and she took the death as a fair death and then kept rolling. The rest of the players, especially the cleric player, the cleric's player got a little upset about the situation just because he was sad that Vestra died. Everybody at the table was sad that Vestra died. We all liked Vestra's character. The cleric player took it a little hard. And rightly so, which just speaks to how well the player brought the character to life, considering these characters started with nothing more than write one interesting thing that happened to your character in their life, and then let's start playing. So it is to everybody's credit how well that went, but the cleric's handling of it, the cleric's, I was going to say epiphany, but the eulogy for Vestra was very well handled. So, the players did it well, and it was a really great scene, a really great situation. Even though I am deeply saddened also by the loss of Vestra. I really liked her, and I had plans for the terrible things that were going to happen to her because she kept pissing everybody off in that town. Anywho, I will jump now with 20 minutes left on my clock. I will jump into Q&A here. So if anybody has any cues they would like me to A, you can type them into the live chat. Otherwise, whatchamacallit. I have a few questions from the Patreon also. And there is one question that I do want to address from the live chat. From the Patreon comments that I'm going to jump to the front of the list because it's a sort of question that is really hard for me to deal with because of the assumptions loaded into it. Okay, so somebody asked, how would you make death saves much, much better in D&D 5th edition? And that was the entirety of the question. Now, I know that I have created this problem because I insist on brief questions that I can answer. But at the same time, I had trouble. I cannot answer this particular question because I am not sure in what sense death saves in 5e need to be. Like, where is the room for improvement? What precisely is the problem? There is this assumption in the question that death saves are self-evidently flawed. And frankly, you know, I can think of a few things that I would, you know, maybe different ways to handle death saves. But the phrasing of how would you make them much, much better with the repeated much strongly implies that the writer of the question believes that there is a self-evident flaw in the death save system. Okay. And I'm not sure. I mean, that's always a dangerous assumption. So, like, I do want questions to be brief, but at the same time, as soon as it's a qualitative and subjective question, like, you know, why is this thing broken? Or how would you fix this broken thing? Because that's really what this is. It's like, from what sense are we coming at this that they are broken and need fixing? So I need a little bit more detail than that. And I just want to caution people, like, if you know, when you're asking a question like that, you know, just take time to ask yourself, am I being subjective here? And, you know, if I'm being subjective, then can I explain myself a little bit more? And if I am being subjective, is there maybe a way, is there maybe a way I can ask a more objective version of that question? Okay. So now, going into the live chat questions, October Foundry would like to know, hi, October Foundry. Did I greet you earlier? I think I did. Are the players aware of the death save policy at the beginning of the campaign? No. In general, players are not aware of my policy of allowing players to veto deaths. Players only discover that the first time they die, quote unquote. That is, the players are aware of the fact that I expect them to settle their death saves in secret without giving any indication. And then when they're, you know, and then if a character is dying and then, you know, someone goes over to examine them, I pull the player aside and say, okay, here's the deal. And so gradually the players learn that that is my policy. That said, I think my current crop of players are aware of it because they've been playing with me long enough to know that's a thing. So, you know, it's not, I don't advertise it, but I don't purposely keep it a secret. And I don't, you know, and I certainly don't lie and say, oh, by the way, we're not doing it now. And then say, by the way, I tricked you. We are doing it. Ha ha ha. Are the content packs a limited edition thing where you only get the ones you're subscribed to, or do you get access to all the previous ones? Okay, so if you are supporting me at the Frenemy level, then you will have access to the content, any content packs I publish while you are supporting me at the Frenemy level, plus any previous ones, because they will be released in the Patreon feed. Once you stop supporting me at the Frenemy level, you will not see future content packs, but any ones that you downloaded and saved, you will, you know, be able to have forever. Okay. And that's just, that's not for any, I'm not, that's not a policy choice so much as that's just kind of how Patreon works. And I don't want to, you know, I'm just going to distribute them through the Patreon feed to subscribers at that level, which means as soon as you become a subscriber at that level, you can go back and get all the ones you missed out on. But as soon as you stop subscribing at that level, you know, you won't have access to them anymore. But they, you know, the ones you saved, you can keep, and future ones you won't see. Okay. Let's see. What do you know now about designing a system that you didn't a year ago? Nothing. I don't know. That's a tough question. I don't think I've really learned, like, I guess... You know, if I'm looking in terms of what I have actually worked on in the last year, I don't think I have done enough full system design now in the past 6 months, you know, in the past recent memory, to say that my approach has changed substantially. I'm sorry, I know that's kind of a cop out, but to be realistic, that's my answer. I don't know that there's anything that has changed about my approach to system design that jumps out at me as, oh, you know what? I have suddenly figured this out. Get back to me in 6 months, because there will be a lot more system design coming in the next 6 months for reasons I can't really talk about just yet. Let's see. Retweeter says, you said that you typically don't go for long backstories. Do you have any special things for expression-focused players to suck up that extra energy at the start of the campaign? No, I don't. If an expression-focused player has every opportunity to express their character and creativity through playing the game. If someone wants to write a short story, I can't stop them. But I am also not going to read it, and I am not going to give them the space to do so. Okay? Expression-focused players are people who want to express their creativity through play. People who want to write long backstories want to write stories. That's not expression-seeking play. Okay? That because writing a backstory is not play. It's as simple as that. Okay. In the Angryverse, our October Foundry asks, in the Angryverse, are souls at higher risk of being lost in the plane of long shadows if their bodies are cremated? My assumption has been no. As long, see, okay. Yeah, that is a deep dive. And I hesitate to really share it because so I do actually keep a lot of the nature of life and death very close to the vest. Because mortals in the Angryverse don't really know how it all works. Okay? So generally, I don't let my players know any more than characters in the world would know until they make those discoveries. Okay? And I did have one group that was starting to kind of tease out what was going on in the Plane of Long Shadows, a.k.a. the Shadowfell, except they were doing it in the Forgotten Realms, but it still was functioning by my rules, so they were starting to try to figure out what the heck was going on, what was the afterlife really like. Okay, what the gods have taught the characters of the Angryverse, is the people of the Angryverse, is that the dead must be properly attended to for two reasons. One is to let their souls make it through the plane of long shadows to the place of judgment and move on. Okay. The other is to prevent undead from getting into the world. Okay, because every time someone dies, you know, the veil parts to let their soul through, and then stuff comes out. Okay, and that stuff is basically all of the negative psychic detritus from all the souls that have passed before it. The idea is that as a soul passes through the plane of long shadows, it sheds all of those things that weigh the soul down from its life. And a soul that is too weighed down or too weak will be destroyed by that journey before it ever reaches its final resting place. So, you know, sinners, when sinners die and they have a lot of guilt and a lot of torment on their soul, their souls are torn apart by their own psychic demons in the beyond. Or alternatively, captured by devils and, you know, there's all sorts of other stuff that can happen. Okay. The gods have taught mortals various ways of dealing with the dead such that it minimizes the risk of undeath. And cremation, as long as proper rites are observed, burial, as long as proper rites are observed, you know, anything that shows a respect for the body and its soul. That is, anything that shows people are willing to make an effort to treat the body and soul as sacred things, even though the person that inhabited them is dead. And as long as it follows the basic instruction manuals, that this is one of the gifts that gods gave mortals, was how to tend your dead. Okay. And I mean, if we wanted to go into it, there's a whole bunch of symbolism in this about the idea of, in order for society to work, in order for people to function and to be civilized, it is important to know how they tend their dead. And that is, they must respect their dead, which is also, they must remember the lessons of the past, and yada, yada. You can go into all of this stuff. I didn't think through all the symbolism at first, but then after you start writing it, it's like, okay, this is what this all means for this world. But anyway, the point is, the gods have taught mortals how to tend their dead. And if the body is cremated properly, with proper rites and rituals observed, in accordance with the lessons of the gods, then know that it doesn't risk destroying the soul. Okay. So that's it. Let's see. East E name or D. Hello, E name or D. Enamored. Hello, enamored. Why is this thing broken? Haha, now that's a PBTA leading question if I've ever heard one. Yeah, okay. Thank you for the great... Okay, Drago wants to know, why does Samus Returns fail to live up to Super Metroid? First of all, why does anything in the Metroid... Like, there are three... Depending on your opinion of the Metroid series, okay, there are three high water marks in the Metroid series: Super Metroid, Metroid Prime, and Metroid Fusion. And depending on what you want out of your Metroid game and how you feel about the Metroid series, one of those will be the best high water mark you can find. Okay? By definition, absolutely everything else will fail to live up to the high water marks. Okay, so for no other reason than that, Samus Returns fails to live up to Super Metroid. Okay, that said, Samus Returns is a remake of Metroid 2, The Return of Samus, and Metroid 2, The Return of Samus was both an intermediate step in the evolution of Super Metroid, but also a departure from the Metroid formula, such as it was at the time, because at that point there was no Metroid formula. But when you consider the whole Metroid formula now, and you look back at Metroid 2, The Return of Samus, you can see the departures from the Metroid formula in it, most of which were necessary for hardware reasons or for making the game work as a portable experience. So, for example, Metroid 2, The Return of Samus, was a highly linear game with a great deal of checkpoints and small chunks of limited exploration. Okay? But at the same time, it was an important step in the evolution of the Metroid series because it introduced a lot of what would be or vital elements of the Metroid formula. I mean, many, many of power-ups that made Super Metroid what it was were actually introduced in Metroid 2. Samus Returns is a remake of Metroid 2, The Return of Samus, that fails to live up to Metroid 2, The Return of Samus. It is, by itself, a good game. Samus Returns is an enjoyable thing to play. But as a remake of Metroid 2, The Return of Samus, I feel it misses the mark. It misses some vital points. And yeah, it also does so thematically. Thematically, there are issues with it. The structure of the game is different, and certain really iconic moments are just really hamstrung in Samus Returns. You know what, though? There was a great comparison. I think it was Game Maker's Toolkit. I'll find it and post a link. I think it was Game Maker's Toolkit that did a comparison between Metroid 2 The Return of Samus, Metroid Samus Returns, or just Samus Returns, and AM2R, the fan-made Another Metroid 2 remake, and compared all three of them. And I don't agree with everything that was said in that video, but I agree with most of it. And so therefore, it will make the argument better than me why I personally found Samus Returns disappointing compared to both AM2R and the original Metroid 2 Return of Samus. Okay? So, yeah, I that was a really long answer, but there you go. Enamored asks, didn't you base an entire campaign around constantly resurrecting characters too? Yes, I did, but weirdly enough, that game was not set in the Angryverse. Because that game predated the campaign that eventually evolved that game predated the campaign setting that became the basis for the Angryverse. And actually what was the basis of the Angryverse was actually the fourth edition Points of Light campaign. And I don't just mean Nentir Vale. I mean the secret, hidden, implied setting in everything, including the preview material. That was the inception of the Angryverse. Okay, so anything I did prior to 4th edition, I did that did not happen in the quote-unquote Angryverse. Though many of my old ideas did end up coming into it in the end. Okay, the constantly resurrecting characters was actually... It was Planescape Torment meets Chrono Cross. Okay? That was the inspiration for the backstory of that campaign. So, yeah. What happened to Stead in the end? K99 asks. I have no idea. Because that campaign ended. The party left him, with his uncle, Elturel. The party left him with his uncle in Elturel. He was infected with Cthulhu at that point, which the party didn't know about. And actually, it is only conjecture that he was infected with Cthulhu because that might have been a lie told by a demon of the Plane of Long Shadows, aka the Shadowfell, just to torment the warlock who maybe had infected him. The party will never know whether that was true or not. And beyond that, after that, I'm led to understand that Elturel was swallowed into the first layer of hell. In a future D&D product. So presumably he was torn apart by devils. So that's probably what happened to Stead. That's canon now. What games related media, blogs, YouTube, podcasts, etc. do you consume out of personal interest, out of professional landscape watching? I don't consume a lot of RPG, like tabletop RPG related media. I consume a lot of video game related media. As it turns out, what tends to happen is I tend to become a fan of a person and then watch a bunch of their stuff and then drift off and then become a fan of someone else. So like for a while I was really into Runehammer's stuff. Who was the guy behind Index Card RPG. I was into his YouTube channel. And then I moved on, and lately I've been doing Professor Dungeoncraft. Yeah, I think it's Professor Dungeoncraft. or DM Craft. So Professor Dungeon Master. Professor Dungeon Master. Yeah. Professor Dungeon Master of DM Craft. I've been watching his channel a lot. He's got some neat stuff. I don't like his approach to some stuff, obviously, but some of his stuff is actually really good, and there's something to learn from a lot of his stuff. So Dungeon Craft. Right. Dungeon Craft is Professor Dungeon Master. Okay. There is a channel called WASD20, I think it is, which did a lot of mapping stuff that I kind of enjoyed. So there's that. Beyond that, I was a fan for a while of Game Maker's Toolkit, but I sort of drifted away from his stuff. He stopped doing things that interested me. And I have since become... There is a... All of these will be linked in the show notes. Yes. Oh, shit. Somebody, quick, type out all of the things I'm saying right now so that I remember to put them in the show notes. Because there's no way in hell I'm listening to this recording again. I need a secretary for these things. Okay, so WASD20 for RPG stuff. Thank you. WASD20. Okay. Game Maker's Toolkit, used to watch their stuff, not so much anymore. Used to watch his stuff, not so much anymore. That's Mark Brown. There's Dungeon Craft. Okay. Wow, October Foundry, you're quick on this. Okay, so Adam Millard, the architect of gaming, has an absolutely fantastic... has an absolutely fantastic YouTube channel about the analysis of video game design. He has become my new Mark Brown, my new Game Maker's Toolkit. There is also someone called, Design Doc. The YouTube channel is called Design Doc. He does a lot of really good design stuff, but he also, he does stuff on graphic visual design in video games. He has a really neat series called Good Design, Bad Design, where he analyzes the visual design of video games, where he talks about like the how information is presented and communicated. But he also does more traditional game design stuff. He had a really interesting one on why critical hits exist, why conditions exist, and why people don't use consumables. Those were three excellent videos of his. So yeah, I highly recommend his stuff because there is a lot of crossover. I like to learn from video game designers because they have, I like to learn from video game designers. I'm just going to leave it at that because now I'm going over time here. So yeah, Adam Millard, the architect of games, Design Doc. Trying to remember, there was another one. Ingenious Clown, but he mostly just does commentary. But yeah, I mean, those are the big ones. So yeah, I mean, that's the... So those are the ones I'm consuming right now as far as video game or as far as game design content. I don't know Jacob Geller, or maybe I do. Is Jacob Geller the name of Ingenious Clown? Or let me see if I can find Ingenious Clown Gaming quick. Ingenious Clown Gaming. Yeah, Ingenious Clown, all one word, gaming. I'll link this one. There. I like his stuff, though he's more of just... He's a little bit more commentary and review and critique, but he does occasionally do deep dive analysis. Oh, and there's one more. Who is it? Psych of Play. I think it's Psych of Play. Or Psych of Play is the series. Yeah, Psych of Play is the series that this guy Daryl Talks Game does. Daryl Talks Games. His stuff is fantastic psychological approach. Video games from a psych standpoint, like how video games does drive decision making and stuff. That is definitely really good stuff. So yeah, that's a bunch of stuff. And yeah, okay, blah. I'm out of practice here. Oh, somebody mentioned Lindy Beige or Lindy Burrs, Lindy Beige. Lindy Beige, who's the other one? Shadiversary. I like Shadiversary stuff. I know some people give Shadiversary shit. I like his stuff. And I like the fact that he will admit at times, like, okay, now I'm looking at this stuff not from a... not from a historical perspective, but from a historical, but from story and gameplay that is also, with an eye toward history. Okay. Like Shadiversary is not, Scaligrim was good too. I haven't watched him in a while. Shadiversity I like only because he does have some feet on the ground where he says, yes, there are historical considerations and we can make these fun videos about historical accuracy, but historical accuracy is not the only thing that you consider when you're making a game or doing a movie or whatever. So when we're looking at this from an entertainment standpoint also. And he maintains that distance that, which keeps him from becoming like a, well, actually kind of obnoxious nerd. So I like Shadiversity stuff for that. And I know some people actually dislike him because he is willing to go away from history sometimes. Anyway. Okay, so that is it. That has been my live chat for the night. I am ending here an hour and 10 minutes. So, only 10 minutes late. Or an hour and 11 minutes. With that, I would like to remind you that the next monthly live chat will be on July 28th at 8 p.m. That's a Wednesday. Wednesday, July 28th, 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Standard, correct time. And meanwhile, this upcoming Tuesday, which is June 22nd, at 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Standard, correct time. I will be hosting a chat where I will specifically talk about the design of Fall of Silver Pine Watch, the module. I have a bunch of questions people have submitted for that. And I'm going to talk about, why I made the choices I did, how the module works the way it is, and what I learned about publishing my first module ever. So that will be next Tuesday, and I hope to see all of you there. Though spoilers will abound, so if you are trying to avoid spoilers, particularly if you're playing in one of my Fall of Silver Pine Watch games, you might want to skip it, wait until you're done, and then come back and listen to the recording afterwards. Meanwhile, thank you everybody for hanging out. Sorry I was a little babbly and unfocused tonight, which that's standard for... You know what? I'm not apologizing for the way I am. I'm babbly and unfocused. I'm a writer, damn it. I don't do this extemporaneous speaking crap. Y'all know what you're getting at this point. Anyway, so that is my live chat. Thank you all for hanging out. Obviously, thank you all for your ongoing support, encouragement, and thank you especially for your patience the last month as I've had to kind of refine my schedule and routine. I look forward to getting you some good fun content and, some good articles. And in the meanwhile, I hope you all enjoy your games and I will talk to you all next month or like tomorrow on the Discord. Now, how do I turn this thing off?